And welcome to episode 107. First thing you all noticed right away is Meredith's not here, right? Well, she was at a seminar with me teaching in Utah, Ogden, Utah. So she was still on a plane, but I'm here. And I'm here with a very, very special guest. It was really tough to book because she's a busy woman, and her name is Dr. Terry Walls. And Dr. Terry, thank you so much for being here.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. I know you're busy, and it was hard to get here, so we are grateful. And, you know, I want to just read your bio for people, and usually that's Meredith's job, but I'll do the best I can. And then I just can't wait to break into this conversation with you. But Dr. Terry Walls is a clinical professor of medicine at the University of Iowa and director, Extended Care and Rehab Service Line at the Veteran Affairs Iowa City Healthcare System. She is also a patient with secondary progressive multiple sclerosis, which confined her to a wheelchair for 4 years, which makes her story very extraordinary, I'll tell you. And Dr. Walls restored her health using diet and lifestyle programs similar to what we do. Go figure. She designed specifically for her brain, and she also tests these principles in clinical trials, which I can't wait to hear about. And she is the author of The Walls Protocol, which is a radical new way to treat all chronic autoimmune conditions using paleo principles. And, you know, gosh, I said before we got on here, Dr. Terry, that it's inevitable that you and I have met, right? I mean, I have such a passion for autoimmune and these brain conditions that are now, I believe, epidemic. And
absolutely.
Unfortunately, modern medicine is not going upstream to the cause. And they're just throwing medications at it, which at best push the symptoms off for a little while, but really have no answer whatsoever. So, you know, Terry, I just want you to tell your story, because I know we have a lot of people watching with multiple types of autoimmune, and I want you to tell that story.
So I'm an academic general internal medicine doc. I believe very much in the best drugs, newest treatments, etc. In 2000, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis on the basis of a new problem with my left leg and a history of visual dimming my left eye 13 years earlier. At that time, I knew the natural history was that within 10 years of diagnosis, one half would develop severe fatigue, unable to work, and that one third would have problems walking, needing a cane, walker, or wheelchair. I decided to find the best clinical centers I could find, so I went to the Cleveland Clinic because they did a lot of clinical research, saw their best people, took the newest, latest drugs, saw the best people here at the University of Iowa. Still within 3 years, my disease had transitioned from relapsing remitting, where you can have periods of improvement and worsening, to the secondary progressive phase, where you expect steady decline and loss of function. So I took the recommended mitoxantrone, got the tilt recline wheelchair, and then I began reading the basic science, reading about the animal models for multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, Lou Gehrig's, Huntington's disease, and would begin to experiment with myself based on what I was reading in the mice and rats. Then, you know, time progressed. I discovered the paleo diet. So after 20 years of being a vegetarian, I went back to eating meat, removed
By the way, Terry, which I would argue was part of the problem.
I agree. Certainly the way I interpreted vegetarianism probably contributed to my illness.
Yeah.
So in 2002, while I was still walking around, I discovered the paleo diet, removed all grain, all legumes, all dairy, introduced meat, and continued to decline. I'm reading the basic science, adding vitamins and supplements. I'm still declining, but more slowly.
Okay.
The summer of 2007, I'm so weak I cannot sit up in a regular chair. I have a zero-gravity chair, recliner at work, another at home, or I'm in bed. I'm losing my keys. I'm losing my phone. I have a detailed notebook to keep track of what I need to do. And my chief of staff calls me in and says, yeah, I'm going to assign you to the traumatic brain injury clinic beginning in January. There'll be no residents. You'll be seeing patients, direct care, along with the team. And I know I can't do that job. It's like, okay, it's pretty clear I'm going to be having to take medical retirement soon. But a few weeks later, I discovered the Institute for Functional Medicine. They have a course, Neuroprotection, a Functional Medicine Approach to Common and Uncommon Neurological Conditions. I get that course. I go through the presentations, the readings. I go over it and over it. And I have a longer list of vitamins and supplements. Now I'm up to 20 different things. And then I have this brilliant awareness or awakening that I should use this list of 20 nutrients to figure out what kind of foods I should be stressing in my diet. So that's more research to figure out, okay, what foods am I going to be doing? And so in January 1, I start this new protocol. Instead of just taking things out, I'm really emphasizing what I need to be eating every day. And that's when the magic begins. Within 3 months, my fatigue is gone. My brain fog is rapidly diminishing. I have to go off Provigil because the fatigue is gone and I can't sleep at night. At 6 months, I'm walking around without a cane. I see my neurologist and I tell him I want to go off the disease-modifying drugs. He agrees, and we taper and discontinue the CellCept. At 9 months, I get up and I get on my bicycle and I pedal around the block for the first time in about 6 years, you know, and I'm crying, my kids are crying, and that's the first time I'm like, you know, nobody knows what's happening, how much recovery might be possible. And then at 12 months, I do a 20-mile bike ride with my family. Now, mind you, I did have to every 5 miles stop, lay down on the grass, rest for a few minutes, then get up on my bike. But
after all, you've been sick for 8 years.
For a long time. Yeah, for a long time. So that really transformed my understanding of disease and health. It would change my clinical practice. And then my chair of medicine called me and said, you know, this is really important, told me to write up a case report. We got it written up. Then he called me and said, we ought to do a little clinical trial. So I wrote up a protocol, wrote a little grant, and I got funding from a group in Canada, Direct MS Charity, and we did our clinical trial, which we've published, and we enrolled people with secondary and primary progressive MS, so people you wouldn't expect to get better, and we emulated the same protocol that I did, the same diet, the same stress reduction and exercise, e-stim, and we had a marked reduction in fatigue, marked improvement in quality of life. We have the gait paper changes that's under review. We're writing up the cognitive changes, which are also quite remarkable. Hopefully we'll be submitting that here in the near future. And I've done a couple of more studies. The MS Society's reviewing grants for us. And so the research program and my lab is growing. And the VA, in the meantime, took me out of primary care, took me out of traumatic brain injury clinic, and we now have basically a functional medicine clinic that I call the Therapeutic Lifestyle Clinic, where I'm teaching people who are willing these concepts. And we are, we're seeing very, very exciting results across a wide variety of disease states.
Yeah, I'd have to say that if you were pursuing this in the university, in the hospital setting, or the regular medical environment without your story, you probably wouldn't have been
well-received
like you have been. Would you agree with that?
You know, when I first started doing this, when I first changed, and I began talking to my vets about the quality of their diet, B vitamins and fish oil, and not talking much about drugs, my primary care colleagues and my traumatic brain injury colleagues started complaining to the chief of staff, said, you know, what's Walls doing? You know, this is not FDA-approved stuff. So he called me in, and I brought in 85 papers and went through this and said, I'm just doing the latest science. And so my chief of staff did become a huge fan. He said, you know, if Dr. Walls hurts somebody, I need to hear about it. But if she's talking vegetables and vitamins, she's fine. So then, seen as an oddity and tolerated, but two things happened. One, our clinical trial is going on. So at Research Week, people were seeing the preliminary data coming back with amazing results, and then I started seeing the videos with amazing results. So that got more stature. And then the clinical outcomes began to speak for themselves in the traumatic brain injury clinic and in primary care. Then the next thing that happens, the chief of medicine comes to see me and says, we'd like to take you out of primary care and have you run your own clinic. And so that was 3 years ago. Now we have the therapeutic lifestyle clinic. That continues to grow. I'm training two of the physicians to be in this with me. In the pain clinic, we are now emphasizing functional medicine, and I'm sending physicians off there to get trained in functional medicine.
Now, that's fantastic. Out of my story, came a greater purpose in, leading people to the truth, where there's so little and, to answers, really. And the same with you. The irony is you and I got sick around the same time. I think, 1999 right into 2000, the back of 1999 right into 2000 is when the bottom of my life fell out too. So both of us kind of hit the wall at the same time, unlike you, I was living a pretty, good diet, exercising, and I had two amalgam fillings drilled out, mercury vapor went, and my life fell apart. That's fine.
Yeah. But I had to get that ill.
Me too.
That disabled in order to have my current understanding of medicine be completely reevaluated. My prior research program was in diagnostic error, secondary data analysis, and so everything that I knew, that's all in a former life, now I have a very different purpose and mission.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it redefines us. I mean, a lot of your message now, I'm sure, is absolutely contrary, 180 degrees opposite of what you thought before. I'm sure, like you many people, you were all about a low-fat diet. Right.
Low-fat diet. I thought vegetarian diet was most ideal. I thought diagnose quickly, treat with medication or surgical intervention procedures as needed. And I thought people were wasting their money on these vitamins and supplements.
Wow.
And now, of course, I realize, they're wasting their money if they're thinking drugs will fix a bad diet and lifestyle problem.
Yeah. I agree. I think we both agree there's a time and a place for medication, but when we're dealing with the chronic illnesses that we are today, it's symptom chasing at best and typically creating more symptoms.
Creating more problems, more nutrient deficiencies, more biologic dysfunction. Absolutely.
Absolutely. I mean, I always say, if there was this rule that you were allowed to use medicine in this acute phase, and if you went beyond there, then, there was a law that you weren't allowed to be on it. I bet we'd save more lives, but that's another
thing. If it got sunsetted after 30 days.
Yeah, exactly, right? Imagine that, right? Because after that is when it goes downhill and we start creating more disease, as you pointed out. Well, tell us. I mean, how does, I'm a firm believer in, obviously fat heals the brain, but, society, the media would say the opposite, right? Fat's bad, let's run from it. And here, you and I, fat, both part of our story, our healing. So talk a little bit about that.
So let's first talk a little bit about how fat became demonized. During World War I, World War II, the death rates for autoimmunity, heart disease, cancers declined. And so when epidemiologists looked at that data, they saw that fat intake during that time declined. And so they attributed fat to be the problem.
Yeah.
And because cholesterol is very loosely correlated with heart disease, it seemed to make sense.
Yeah.
And there was a political drive to do something about the obesity epidemic, and so that seemed to be the right thing. The NIH ended up funding some research and putting a lot of money into the fat hypothesis. There's a lot of drug development. If you drove cholesterol down really far, you do save some heart attacks. You cause increased rates of homicide, suicide, depression, and dementia. And so the net all-cause mortality did not change. Now that has been re-examined, and we realized that you could make the same conclusions about sugar, because sugar intake went dramatically down. Also during World War I, World War II, people were encouraged to eat and grow their own vegetables and eat from their garden, so the vegetable intake actually went up during that time period. So that's the history of how we got sidetracked into the fat problem.
Alan Keyes had a big role in that. Remember in Time Magazine?
You know? Alan Keyes, I was the big epidemiologist who said fat is the problem. You could take that same data and say sugar is the problem.
You could take that same data and actually say fat was actually a good thing. You know, it's like, I mean, the countries that he took in that study, you know, it really played played a role.
Absolutely. Now, if we look at the biochemistry of it, we need fat, and we need cholesterol, we need saturated fat, we need some omega-3, some omega-6, because all of those things are in our cell membranes. And if we drive our fat down, we don't have as healthy of a cell membrane, which means we don't have as healthy of a brain, because we need cholesterol, saturated fat, omega-3, omega-6 fat for all the myelin in my brain.
Yes.
And we need those fats, they act as cell signaling in our brain as well. So huge problem. Yeah. If we fat starve our brains as adults, and even more, a greater problem if we fat starve our children's brains.
There's no doubt. You know, and the ratio of omega-3 and omega-6 is really shown to change brain function. You know, people are eating grain-fed animals with these ratios of omega-6 that are very high.
And all those corn oils, soybean oils, sunflower oils, all these oils, very, very high in omega-6. Mm-hmm. We're heating those fats, making more trans fats as we cook with them.
Look at all the vegetable oils we're heating. It's just, you know, the wrong...
Disastrous.
Yeah.
Absolutely disastrous.
We're speaking the same language. Actually, you know, I have something, Terry, that I teach called my 5 R's of cellular healing, and I started teaching it just because I was having trouble communicating, you know, how to fix the cell to doctors, saying, this is the key, this is the key. And I, you know, I developed the 5 R's, you know, honestly, it was how it came to me. It was divine in nature, I'm telling you. But R number one is you have to go upstream and remove the sources, right, that drive information. Typically, these are toxic and stressors in nature. Could be chemical, physical, or emotional. And then R number two is fix the cell membrane, or regenerate the cell membrane, mm-hmm. use the R's correctly. And that's where these fats come in, you know, in the right ratios. And fats like cholesterol and saturated fats, which have been demonized.
What ratio do you like to...
You know, obviously in nature we see from, you know, 1 to 1 omega-6, omega-3 to, you know, 5 to 1, you know, in nature. You know, I've read many studies. I like, for brain fixing, I like a 4 to 1 ratio of omega-6.
Yes.
Yeah. 4 to 1 ratio has been shown. You know, Terry, I think we unite on this. I mean, I think that one of the problems we're seeing today, here's what I see. In the health, a lot of my listening audience, they're all taking fish oils. Now, probably 80% of their taking are rancid, but let's say they get a good one, okay? They, in the beginning, because they're omega-6 dominant from eating all the corn and grain-based stuff, it works, and they see a positive. But then they pass that line of that ratio, and now what we're finding is a lot of the health enthusiasts are omega-3 dominant, which is a new problem. And right? And it's like... kicks cardiolipin out of the cell membrane, the mitochondrial membrane, it creates all these other new issues. Do you feel that? Do you see that as well?
You know, I think ideally you monitor the fatty acid ratio in cell membranes so you know you aren't overshooting. And this is the problem when we use supplements as opposed to food. We get ratios wrong. And we don't know when to stop that we've got the tank back in the right direction.
Right.
Nearly every nutrient has a U-shaped curve, even water. So if you're too low, big trouble. Nice broad range, we're going to be okay. Too high, we become toxic again. And we're suppressing the effect of the other correlate nutrients. In this case, omega-3, omega-6, or zinc and copper. And that's why, you know, a lot of people want to talk to you about supplements. And I'm like, you know, I really like talking about food. I want you to have those supplement conversations with your healthcare practitioner so they can guide you so you don't overshoot.
Yeah. Terry, I love when I unite with somebody. You know, I mean, the 4-to-1 ratio of 6-to-3 is that targets the brain and the cell membrane, by the way, when you look at the studies. Yeah. We're in alignment there completely.
Absolutely.
You know, and I love that. You know, it is, the magic is, you know, oftentimes in the food. And you're right. People, if you're going to do this, doing it by yourself, you need a coach that understands this, right? I mean, you know, there is no doubt about it. And that's my goal of teaching doctors, you know, around the country. You know, but there are these balances that you can just drive. Listen, everybody, think about this, Terry, and I know you experienced this. Four things that everyone that you see and I see, right, if we just get into a conversation with the public, they're on a multivitamin, which is typically more toxic than it is good. They're on vitamin D that's not balanced with K, causing functional deficiencies in vitamin A, right? So they're just typically just taking vitamin D. And then there's the probiotic, that the same one they've been on for a year, which is causing dysbiosis, and we'll get to the microbiome in a moment. And then they're on the fish oil, driving themselves in omega-3 dominance, and it's probably rancid anyway. Am I right? Are those the four things that everyone in America is taking, and they're typically making themselves worse?
Certainly a lot of folks are on those, and there's a high likelihood of getting into trouble. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's remarkable, honestly. So, look, I when I talk about autoimmune, I like to put it in context of a three-legged stool. You know, we have, meaning that the three-legged stool. If one of these things isn't there, you won't probably get it. If one of these three things isn't there, you probably won't fix it. So the one leg is a certain gene gets turned on. And, you know, we have to change that epigenetic. I mean, we get the autoimmune of our genetic weakness. The second leg is the stressors, physical, chemical, emotional, that trigger the gene. If we don't get upstream to removing those, we typically won't turn the gene off. And then the last leg is this gut issue. We know that certain bacteria, when missing, we can't even make something called a T regulatory cell that actually turns off our immune system to say, hey, everything's okay. So now we have a society that has leaky gut, you know, exposed to chemicals and things killing bacteria, even from birth on. So fixing the gut, going upstream and detoxing the cell and taking the stressors away and turning off the bad genes. You know, those three things is, you know, what I identify. Start with the microbiome, because you have a lot of study here, and I want to hear from you on what's going on in the gut. Why is it a player, not only, and what are you doing to fix it?
So in the clinical trial that we're doing right now, enrolling folks and putting them in either the Swank diet or the Walls diet, we're monitoring their microbiome. So they're pooping in a cup for us, and we'll see how the microbiome is before they get enrolled, because we'll watch them for a few weeks. We enroll them, and then we're going to monitor how the poop changes. And we'll see the changes in the two diets. I think some of the observations I have so far is that there's a lot of species variation, that is census taking that we do. Then there's metabolic measurements that we do to see, given the bacteria that live in my bowels, what are all the metabolic functions that they have for me? Because I think the problem is when we are don't have enough gut bacteria diversity, I don't have all of the metabolic robustness that I should have. And so we can replace that with the species. Which species I need may be different from person to person. Absolutely. What I'm really trying to do is fill in that metabolic hole. So if I have 2,000 different species in my guts, I'm more likely to have a robust metabolic function of my bowels.
Right.
If I have only 600 species or only 500 species, because I've taken so many antibiotics and I eat so much sugar, so few vegetables, I have far less metabolic robustness in my gut, which means there's less metabolic activity that gets transferred across into my bloodstream going up to the portal vein. And my health suffers.
So stop there. So diversity, right? I read it in the studies as well, right? Diversity is the key. And my comment earlier, just the taking the same darn probiotic really isn't, let's face it, Terry, you know, I mean, it can help in the beginning, of course, any probiotic, right? It can make a difference. But then, you know, it's probably the same 7 or 11 species that are in every probiotic out there. How are we gaining this diversity? How are you gaining the diversity with the tools that we have?
Who lives in my bowels depends so completely on what I'm eating. So if I want more diversity, I have to have more fiber, more soluble fiber, more resistant starch. And if I'm not pooping 2 or 3 snakes a day, I need more of that stuff. Having more fermented vegetables, having a plateful of fermented red cabbage or kimchi adds far more diversity than a probiotic, adds much bigger numbers. And having 9 cups of vegetables will do a lot of pooping for most people. But if somehow it's not enough, then I have them take more psyllium husk or chia seed or ground flax seed or raw potato starch or inulin or larch. You know, they can sort of take their pick. And frankly, I like them to be diverse. The other thing that I tell people I do is I work on growing organic soil in my garden, and I have a lot of root vegetables. So I'll go out, I'll pull out my radishes, my onions, I wipe them off a little bit, get most of the dirt off, and then I eat them.
I want to hug you right now. I don't, you know, this is my language. This is what you and I are very much in alignment on the microbiome. Very good.
You know, if we look at the hunter-gatherer societies, the Hadza, they've got like 1,200 different species, 1,600 different species in their guts. And then we found the Yamanami, and they had like 3 times as much. And so what are they eating? They're eating, some vegetables, some tubers, whatever they got caught that day. And, you know, they're not washing their hands a lot. They probably have a lot more exposure to dirt.
Yep.
And so I predict there may be a time that healthcare practitioners will be talking to people about growing dirt and having organic dirt that we consume and that we're going to rely on our stomach acid to take out the troublesome bacteria. Right. And that we're going to shift our thinking on, is this bacteria a pathogen, to is this community well balanced, so that all the metabolic functions I need are happening. Oh, wait a minute, I'm missing some metabolic function. So I'm going to go get some more of this fermented cucumbers or fermented squash or fermented beets because they're going to give me more of those bacterial species that I need.
Well, I tell you, you know, I'm a big fan of all the fermented stuff you mentioned and all the dirt, you know, and some of my favorite bacteria products are dirt, you know. Zach Bush's new product, Restore, I'm going to have him on here in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
You know, it's from 7 layers deep in ligite. I mean, it's dirt. Dirt products.
We got so excited when we discovered bacteria and discovered some pathogens, but that's far too simple. Life is a much more complicated interaction of all of these life forms, this whole ecosystem that each one of us is. And so if we want to be healthy, it's like having to fix the health of the ecosystem of Flint now that you have to fix their water.
Oh, I'm going this Thursday. They're bringing me out there.
Excellent.
Doctors. Yeah, the mayor's going to be there. I'm teaching doctors on what I do, cellular detox and how to...
Excellent. Man, yeah. I am so glad to hear that.
Yeah,
let me know. I'll be delighted to promote your being there. That's just wonderful to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And I'm sure we'll do more, but yeah, they're flying me out there, and I have a lot of the heads from the hospitals, the doctors coming, and so it's going to be a great opportunity to make a difference in a really horrible area. But sorry to interrupt you. I just got very excited about that when you said that.
So it's all about teaching people the human ecosystem. We have to clean our ecosystem, reduce the tox, get more vegetables, nourish our bacterial friends.
Yeah, no, it absolutely. And, you know, our cleanly society from, not, you know, hand washing to antibiotics, overuse of antibiotics, to the hand sanitizers that are everywhere, to the hand sanitizer antibacterial soaps. I mean, it's remarkable. And then, you know, of course, we're putting a glyphosate in our food system, which is the number one herbicide pesticide in the world, that's wiping out bacteria as well. It's not surprising that the majority of the population has a leaky gut and a dysbiosis of these bacteria that you and I understand not only affects your digestion, but affects your immunity, drives autoimmune, and also affects the brain because you can't make the chemicals that this brain works with without certain bacteria. This is the epidemic, Terry.
Absolutely. You know, and glyphosate is in the rain. Glyphosate is in the rain. And so that has just profound implications for all of us because that's going to get into the soil in my organic garden as well.
And it's devastating to the gut microbiome. And it's so sad, you know, what it's doing to our children. I have five kids, and when they get in their 30s, I cannot imagine, Terry, the level of autoimmune that we're driving. Because think of it, glyphosate turns all the bad genes. Glyphosate causes a disruption in the microbiome. So all legs of the stool, glyphosate fills, you know, and it leads to the...
Are you aware of Pottinger's cats?
Yes.
For the listeners, Pottinger...
Sorry, I've got my dog problem here.
We have dogs, too. I enjoy that. So he did a series of experiments with cats where he observed that if the cats were fed cooked meat, they're clearly missing some nutrient, which led to congenital malformations that were more severe with each successive generation. And I believe the fourth generation was the last generation that could reproduce. The fifth generation was sterile. Now, it's not exactly a corollary for us, but if we go to World War II, that's when, 1950, the use of chemicals in the food supply and in agriculture really became very, very intensive. So from 1950 to 2000, two generations, we're in the third generation, and we see with each generation more serious behavioral problems in our children, higher rates of autism, higher rates of cancers. We've been seeing in the young adults higher rates of infertility. And, of course, just higher rates of autoimmunity, obesity. So our fourth generation will be 2050. Will we be sterile? Will we have severely reduced fertility? I think that's certainly quite possible.
Yeah, I do too.
Now, I'd also tell you, I tend to be a half full glass kind of person. So at the same time, the internet was invented. And it was the internet that allowed me to make my personal discovery of functional medicine, the research that I was able to do to create the protocol which has restored my health. And I was restoring the health of millions.
Yeah.
Because of the internet, the public is able to learn far more quickly, stay current with the latest science. The government will never fix this. Insurance companies can't do it. Businesses can't do it. But we, the public, as long as we have access to the internet, and we can do these podcasts, do social media, tell our story, the people... Some of us, at least, are going to figure this out.
Hey, Terry, as long as we keep our freedom, right? In this country, I always worry, right? It's like, because you're right. You're right. I'm with you on that, that it is this freedom that we're able to, you know, enjoy.
As long as we can publish and talk to each other about our own personal experience.
Right.
And I'm careful to always disclose my story. Research is ongoing. More stuff has to be answered. But if these... You know, interventions sound pretty low risk, vegetables and fiber. Removing a few things that are not so good for you, try it and see what you think.
Get the good fats that everyone's telling you to stay away from, right? The high fats.
I have bacon and greens. They're like, you could do what? You know, one of the favorite things I get to say to vets in my class is my daughter and my kids had a favorite saying, bacon will fix any vegetable. And so I tell them, yes, cut up a couple pieces of bacon, fry them up, Leave the fat in the skillet, add your vegetables, cook 2 minutes, and eat. And if you don't like it, add 2 more pieces of bacon the next time you make that dish. And keep adding it until you're feeling good, because you just need enough fat to cut the bitterness.
You know, it's fine. I agree totally. You know, when you mentioned the Hunza people, right? And it's remarkable. I'm going to put this in your head, and you can, you know, ponder it. I wrote an article called Diet Variation, and, you know, I love the change the diet, because I believe that it emulates what our ancestors were forced to do. So when you look at the Hunza people, the British would go there, and they would think that they're vegetarians. They'd go in the summer, and they were just gathering some berries and eating vegetables and things, and so surely they're vegetarians. Well, they never went in the winter. When all they were eating was lard, cheese, their yogurt, their fermented products that they could keep in the winter.
Yeah.
And then something, so they weren't eating vegetables. And then something remarkable happened in the spring. They didn't have food. They were in between. They ran out of meat and lards, and you know, and then they didn't have their vegetables yet. They called it starvation spring. So, Terry, I emulate those cycles when I work with people. We do periodic fasts. We do even fast, and we change the diet around at times, because it forces the body to adapt, and bad cells have trouble adapting. So yeah, check my article. But
that's awesome.
When we study you know, these tribes and these cultures that have just done so well, the variations that they were forced into really made them a stronger people. So that's
and they also have 200 different species that they eat. So you know, so I talk about keep track. It's sort of fun to do, a little notebook of the various plants you're eating, and the animals you're eating, and are you going to make 200? So when I started doing that, then I noticed my thinking changed. I go to the grocery store, there's a new food that shows up, and I'm like, oh my God, I got to try that out, because I know I'm working on my 200.
Yeah.
So, and then when I go down to the tea and spice aisle, it's like, man, I got to try. I try new teas, new spices, because I'm very intentional. I want to be well beyond 200 different species.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You know, we've lost our relationship with plants, and not just plants as we think them, but the herbs, right?
Yes.
You know, I mean, think about it. Cultures were, you know, herbs, they were gatherers. They half of their vegetables, maybe not half, but a larger percent of their vegetables were actually herbs. You know, they utilized herbs.
They're probably our original superfood.
Yeah.
Because they were so powerful that the societies appreciated the tremendous healing capacity of those herbs, those plants. And so they became a part of their culinary tradition.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about methylation, because, you know, were a vegetarian. You said it, and I agree, you know, part, not all, but it was the vegetarian diet that possibly methylation, the low fat, all that was part of it. But, you know, methylation, we know today, can turn off bad genes and protect genes. And surely you and I both at one point were methyl depleted. Matter of fact, I said I have my 5 R's. R number 5 is reestablishing methylation. So many people today are methyl depleted because of stress, whether it's emotional, chemical, physical, it all depletes methylation. Talk a little bit about that, because I know it's part of what you do.
Well, you know, there's the methylating factors and the B vitamins, and for certainly vegetarians, they're going to be low on B12. As we age and mature, get over 50, and I passed that a few years ago, again, your ability to make intrinsic factor declines.
Yeah.
And we commonly prescribe medications that lower stomach acid, and also for the compromise, your ability to make intrinsic factor. We also, you know, organ meats, great source of B12. We don't eat nearly enough of that as well.
So we aren't a lot of it.
You know, and our ancestors knew would have had about a third of their meat be organ meats. You know, I have this lovely, lovely cookbook from my great grandmother. The Companion of Cookery and Modern Book of Knowledge from 1857. And they're talking about eating the whole animal, eating the organ meats. And that was a vital part of how you took care of your family.
Yeah.
And growing up, we had liver and onions every Friday night. Now, you know, and my family eats liver and onions and organ meats quite regularly. Both of my kids know how to make liver and onions in a very delicious way, and broil bacon-wrapped chicken livers. That's what I call our surprise yummies. We make it for guests coming over. Don't tell them what they've eaten until afterwards. They're like, "Oh my God, that was, you know, that was delicious." So it's very common to have nowhere near enough B12. If you're a vegetarian, you're very likely to have not enough B12.
Yeah.
You might have enough folate, but you need both the B12 and the folate to do really
Even
well.
Creatine plays a big role in methylation, you know, which people don't realize.
And as a vegetarian, I think it'd be pretty tough to have enough creatine.
Yeah, absolutely. What's your feeling on, it's kind of in vogue right now. I probably get questions every day on it. And a few years ago, I was really excited about it, and I've become a little less excited about it. But all the SNPs, what value do you think is in it and or not?
So, I think it's the most...
I said SNPs, so I probably lost people.
Yeah.
If I said the word MTHFR, genotype, then maybe I pulled people back in. That's called a genetic SNP, folks. And so, Terry, answer with that.
So, SNP is single nucleotide polymorphism. It's how we get variation. We've identified at least 10 million variations. It's not so pricey. I could get my entire DNA sequenced. I could take my report in to my doc and say, what does this mean? And they're like, oh my God, I can't deal with that. You could give your report to another company that does an analysis to say, based on your SNPs, we're going to recommend you have five variations that say you need to take methyl B12, curcumin, and resveratrol. But to go further down the report, and it says that you have seven SNPs that you should not take any resveratrol. You cannot metabolize curcumin, and you're at risk of becoming B12 toxic. So the observation that I make is this is far more complex than we realize. Our ancestors handled those SNPs pretty damn well. They were out eating food, moving around, being exposed to daylight, going to bed when it was dark, having sex with people that they liked, hopefully, and having social networks that were supportive. Our problem is not likely our SNPs. Our problem is far more likely our diet and lifestyle choices. It's true, I could have a very resistant, difficult disease. I've been doing all the right diet and lifestyle stuff. I could do a genetic analysis, get some SNPs, and it could tell me that I don't have wild type genes for how I handle B12. I have four SNPs, but it won't tell me if those SNPs make my B12 enzymes more efficient or less efficient.
Absolutely.
So I would have to do nutritional assays to figure out, do I have a B12 problem or not? Have I compensated adequately with my dietary change or not? So my feeling is, for most of us, SNPs are not going to give very useful information. A detailed nutritional metabolic activity certainly could. A detailed poop analysis metabolic activity might, but that's really much more of a research question yet.
Mm-hmm.
We'll probably get into a point where I can understand that. People with a lot of money want to spend it on stuff. I'd rather they spend it on organic.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, when it started coming out, I put a lot of time into it, looked at it, and started trying to find more clinical benefit. And at the end of the day, I said, it's really not changing my clinical outcomes or my doctors. I think there's some benefit to it. I mean, I think we can look at certain weaknesses, but you answered the question. You know, you said, yeah, okay, great. You may have the MTHFR gene, but what other adaptations that we haven't discovered yet? Are turned on to make you more sensitive, more absorbent of B12 and folic acid, and utilizing it differently. You know, we genetically run around other weak pathways, and we haven't even figured it out yet, honestly, because that answers the question of why you can have the worst genetic types, and yet they have no problem with methylation or folate.
And we already know that their ancestors had reproductive success.
Yeah.
So at some point, those SNPs worked well in our past, or worked well enough that you could have sex and have kids.
Absolutely. Just because you have this SNP that we think is bad, I promise you there's probably two others that go with that one, that why it's you're here and you're successful.
Correct. So, yeah, I think it's far more important to help people understand diet and lifestyle choices and how to do them more effectively. Mm-hmm. Now, and I have plenty of people who are still pre-contemplative. They can't quite get their head around our approach. But we also have plenty of folks who are able to dive very deep in this remaking of their lives.
Yeah. Well, one more perhaps controversial question. We're both big into the microbiome. What's your feeling on, and I don't want to get anyone in trouble here, the FDA could be potentially listening, but fecal transplant. I mean, for beyond C. diff, okay. I mean, as far as bringing in, because I've seen miracles happen here. Of course, so, I'm not doing them, but I've seen miracles happen and have heard of the miracles.
Certainly, if we go in the U.S., the FDA has determined that the only thing that they're not going to hassle people over is refractory C. diff.
Correct.
If you're doing transplant for any other reason, you're going to be in trouble with the FDA. So we've certainly seen many people going over to the Tamount Clinic in London. They've now opened a branch in the Bahamas. And they do a nice history, evaluate, do you probably have a high risk of having diminished bacterial diversity? And they'll tell you that they can give you 10 fecal transplants over 10 days that will greatly enhance your diversity in your gut.
Yeah.
Likely reduce any gut symptoms, and we don't know what effect it will have on your other chronic health issues.
Yeah.
It may have no effect, or it may have a dramatic effect.
And by the way, I've seen just that when
you've
gotten them done. Dramatic. I mean, shuts down all their autoimmune, I mean, massive, and I've seen
Parkinson's, MS, people who are in wheelchairs who are walking again. It is, for some people, very dramatic. Now, if they don't radically change their diet,
they're going to kill them.
They can't keep their friends around, and they'll lose their diversity and their autoimmunity.
Dr. Terry, I found the same thing too. People that are very toxic and keep moving toxins out of their body, they can just keep killing all of the new guys, the good bacteria that they keep putting in. So, it's that three-legged stool. We have to fix the microbiome, the gut. We have to get rid of the stressors, and ultimately that will change the genome. And of course, I give nutrients here that focus on the genome and protecting the genome. That's where my five R's interplays. So, Terry, time just flew by. I feel like...
Oh, my goodness, that was lots of fun.
I know, right? I could just go on and on. It's remarkable that you and I have never met like this, and yet we agree so much. And I'm going to fly out there one day and see what you have going on.
Well, every summer we do a seminar for the public, 3 days, talking about the Walls Protocol, teach them what's the latest research, what we're doing in the research lab. This year we're adding a health practitioner workshop day, and I'm adding a certification program. So
yeah, well, that's great.
We've got to train more people to think the way we think.
Yeah, that's been my passion now, right? I mean, I take some clients on, virtually, not as many as I used to, but my passion is really training more doctors to do what we're doing, the things we're talking about here, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Everything that we've spoke about, people need coached. I always say you don't need more treatments. You need to learn, folks listening, what Terry and I are talking about, and we're both passionate about training up a new type of doctor that understands this, so...
A new generation of health professionals.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you for your service. And, thank you for coming on this show, because I'm telling you, you're changing lives. We reach a lot of people through this show. And give your website again.
Terry Walls, T-E-R-R-Y, Walls, WAHLS.com. I'm on Facebook, Terry Walls, MD, and on Twitter, Terry Walls. Come check out what we're doing, sign up for the newsletter, come to our seminar, learn a lot, change the world.
Yeah. Well, I'm behind everything that you're doing there, and keep us abreast of more of the clinical studies and trials, because we'll put it to practice. We want to teach and do what's working.
Sounds like a plan. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for in your busy schedule making it happen. Thank you, Tara.
You're welcome. Bye-bye now.
All right. Bye-bye.
The information shared on today's show can be accessed through our websites, drpompa.com and revelationhealth.com. This Cellular Healing TV episode and past shows are also available for download on iTunes. Help others get real health solutions by liking, reviewing, and sharing our podcasts.